Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show, we'll get to talk with Dr. Roger Schwartz, author of Smart Leaders, Smarter Teams. I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Yes, I think this can help us. Maybe we can be
a smarter team together.
Christy. There you go. But first, we got some research that matters about exercise and colon cancer.
And about changing food labels to help people understand the health of the foods.
And we'll find out what we're doing about aspirin and a possible effect on eye loss.
And about any relationship between sleep and memory loss.
Well, let's dive right in here about exercise, which, Christy, you and I, we really talk about. This is one of the most powerful pills out there. And this is some research that seems to even bolster that hypothesis.
So this was research looking at 2,300 people who developed colon cancer out of an initial pool of 184,000 of volunteers. And they followed them over time, over 8 years, to figure out what was any relationship between exercise and death.
Right. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, and they basically found that those who were the most active, sometimes to, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours of moderate to, you know, pretty intense exercise a week, compared to those that were kind of couch potatoes, spending 6 or more hours on the couch a day, that those people were more exercise had a really much less chance of dying of their colon cancer than those who did no exercise.
They were 28-42% less likely to die during that follow-up period than the people who didn't exercise at all. But, I mean, we can't say that it's the exercise itself that improves their survival chances.
Why not?
Well,
we can say
it's
that.
One piece of a healthy lifestyle that probably all contributes to it.
Right. And also maybe the people who exercise are doing other things.
Already,
right.
Right. Exactly. Or maybe they were already a healthier group in some way. But I do think it's one other piece of information to support exercise in general. And certainly if you're a cancer survivor, to let that be one more reason to move your body.
That's right. Instead of one less reason. You can have to be maybe exercise rehab for cancer patients. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't think of it only for heart patients, but it is for cancer patients too. What about our very next research that matters, Christy, about food labels in an article in the Journal of Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics?
This was a study to see if changing nutrition labels on packaging to clearly display the total number of calories in the package instead of sort of the confusing labels that we have now, if changing that would help people better understand the health value of certain foods.
Yeah, right now, when you get a product like potato chips, it'll say how many calories per serving and then how many servings are in there and how much fat and vitamins per serving. The problem is that it'll say you may have 8 servings in there, and some of us might eat it in 3 servings.
Or one.
And we can get tremendous amounts of calories and fat and salt and not even be aware of it, maybe.
It's true. I think the way we list it is confusing. I'm paying a lot more attention to it now because I'm logging on my foods for Weight Watchers. I could do it on my
smartphone.
You're
getting paid to do this for Weight Watchers?
No. But it makes me log all these labels, and it really is confusing. Even after having gone to medical school and public health school and all of that, it's hard to keep track of what the different values mean.
Right. In this particular study, they surveyed close to 10,000 adults and showed them 10 different types of food labels, and basically found that it's better to have the total number of calories in the product, and the entire package will probably end up ultimately helping people make more choices. But in other places in the world, like in Britain, they actually have these very complex labels where they have them in different colors, in green and yellow and red. I can see it getting a little bit complicated here, and a lot of people just sitting there reading in the stores. That's a good thing.
I think so. I think we should simplify it so that you don't have to have, you know, advanced degrees in nutrition to be able to understand it. It's confusing. We should make it simple.
I agree with that. Well, let's talk about simple. Unfortunately, our next research that matters, it's not so simple. And this was an article in one of the Journal of the American Medical Association specialty journals, Internal Medicine, about aspirin use and macular degeneration, or one of the more common causes of blindness.
So they looked to see, in Australia, researchers looked to see if taking an aspirin, at least one aspirin every week, is linked to the development of this age-related vision loss. And they found that seniors who take a daily aspirin are more likely to develop macular degeneration.
Right. They surveyed almost 2,500 people, and of those, 250 took at least an aspirin every week, and 63 people who were taking these aspirin had developed this macular degeneration, which was about 5.5% of regular aspirin users, compared to only 2.5% of those who didn't take regular aspirin. So the question came up, is this aspirin use a cause of the macular degeneration? And the researchers were quick to say, can't say that, and I agree with them.
Well, and I also think it's important. There are many people take aspirin to prevent heart disease or to prevent a second heart attack. And those things are very, very common. And aspirin can be helpful in that setting. And so I don't want to scare people away from taking their regular aspirin for something so common or that might be indicated for fear of this other thing. I think it's a conversation you should have with your doctor, but we should interpret it cautiously.
And one of the reasons people actually get put on aspirin is because they have these TIAs, these transient ischemic attacks, where they may actually lose a little bit of their vision momentarily, and that aspirin could be life-saving there. So you really have to talk with your doctor about why you might be on the aspirin and why maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do our last one. And this is about sleep, something that I love to do, and about reducing memory loss, which I think a lot of people are nervous about their risk of memory loss with aging.
And this was in the journal Nature, which is a premier scientific journal, has a lot of basic science. But this was a really interesting research where they took two groups of one group of younger people and one group of older people, and they gave them a common set, I think it was 15 in each group, a common set of problems to solve, word problems, and they had them do them before they went to sleep, half of them, and then after they woke up to do the other half, and they found changes in the older people's ability to do those problems, and those changes could be due to sleep patterns.
But they also concluded that they couldn't say whether the changes in the brain were related to or like causing altered sleep patterns, or if the changes in sleep patterns could somehow be related to the memory impairment. So it's one of those chicken or egg things, but I think it is a step forward in us trying to understand the relationship between sleep and memory.
Right, because, you know, as people do get older, certain parts of their brains get smaller, and there are certain decreased levels of the non-REM associated sleep that can cause sleep problems, and long-term memory may get impaired. And if you're able to reverse some of this ultimately by having better sleep patterns, boy, wouldn't that be an amazing breakthrough? If you could do it.
If you could do it. And wouldn't that be great? I would love for a doctor to order me to get more sleep.
Well,
why don't you do that? You could tell me to get more sleep right now.
You'll see me afterwards, Christy. We'll see what that'll cost you. But, well, that's had a chance for us to talk about colon cancer survival and perhaps maybe many cancers by getting regular exercise.
Talk about changing food labels to boost understanding.
And I must say, Christy, when I was thinking about food labels, I've been looking a lot at salt recently, and it's amazing some of the things that look really healthy when you see, you know, and it says, you know, per serving, but you see, God, there's enough real only food in here for like one serving. And what you think you're going to get like a half of a gram of salt, and you get like 1.5 grams of salt.
It's like half what you should get in a day.
Absolutely. So food labels important, and aspirin use. And talk with your doctor if you have any vision problems. Make sure it's right for you. And for most people, it probably is.
And finally, about the possible link between memory loss and sleep.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with our guest, Dr. Roger Schwartz, author of Smart Leaders, Smarter Teams. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we get the pleasure of talking with Dr. Roger Schwartz, author of the new book, Smart Leaders, Smarter Teams, about how to get unstuck in doing the work that all of us need to do, which increasingly is about teams. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Christy.
Oh, thanks for being with us. I understand this is a second book that builds off an original book. I wonder if you'd share the story with us of what led you to write these books.
Sure. The first book I wrote was in the mid-1990s, and it was called The Skilled Facilitator. And it was designed to help facilitators, consultants, and coaches and managers to help their teams become more effective. But it was really written for people on the outside of the teams, helping the teams.
Like?
It could be anyone who is inside an organization who is called on by a team. The team says, hey, we're going to have a particularly difficult meeting, and we're going to need some help.
Some people would say all their meetings are particularly difficult.
And also, one of the things you find is you don't know how difficult the meeting is going to be until you're already in it, which is one of the reasons why I ended up writing the second book, The Smart Leader, Smarter Teams. One of the things that we found when we started to work with our clients is they said, this is great, this is really helpful, but we don't want this just available for our facilitators and for our organization development professionals and our HR professionals. We need this set of skills and this mindset for the leaders of the teams and the team members themselves. For the very reason that you said, Adam, sometimes for teams, every meeting is difficult. And in other cases, you don't know when your meeting is going to be difficult. So if everyone has these as core competencies,
Skills.
If everyone has this set of skills and this sort of way of thinking about working together as a team, the team can be much more effective day in and day out.
Well, we're gonna come to that second, but I want to ask you a question, because in reading your book, you have this story of you as a child first kind of getting interested in this issue, and you tell that story briefly if you can about how you came to the table, so to speak, even before you had a skill set.
Are you referring to the example in my hotline experience when things didn't go well, or to another experience?
Well, tell us the hotline one.
Okay. When I was growing up, I had a lot of experience working on teams. I spent a great deal of my time working with other teenagers in structured settings, and one of them was working on a hotline. We started a hotline in the 1970s to help other teens deal with
like issues. Suicide prevention.
Exactly. Deal with issues of suicide, other problems that they were facing. And we made decisions by consensus, and the consensus meant that everyone would support the decision. And almost always, I was the one person out, so to speak. Everyone agreed except for me. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why everyone didn't understand what I understood, which was, of course, the right answer.
You were right. They were wrong.
I was right.
You're that lone jury person on that jury hanging out there when everyone else says, let's get this done.
Absolutely. I had the truth, capital T, and I just could not get other people to see it. And it was frustrating. And that was really a significant event for me. It's not really an event, an experience over a period of years and trying to figure out, well, why is it that that couldn't work? Why is it that I couldn't be effective?
And that led you into organizational psychology as a place to really dive into that further and help other people?
I was always interested in psychology, and in college, I think it was my sophomore, junior year, someone said, you know, there's a field for people who are interested in psychology and organizations. And I said, really, what is it? And they said, organizational psychology.
That's great.
I was sold.
Well, thinking about this book and your target audience, you say, are the leaders of the teams for this particular one, helping people get unstuck. Give us a picture of, or maybe a couple pictures of what that means. What kind of person would be excited as a leader to read this team for? What kind of stuck do you mean?
What I mean by stuck is a leader who is thinking about his or her team and isn't getting one of several kind of results. Either the leader is realizing that the team is not performing well. They're not making high quality decisions, because that's what leadership teams make. They don't make services or products. They make decisions. So the decisions that they're making are poor. There's not any commitment to those decisions from the team members, so that they're not implemented well, or they're not implemented in a way that's timely because people are dragging their feet. The team really spends more than it needs to. That is, the decisions have a lot of a cost associated with them that don't need to be there. So there's a whole kind of performance part that a leader may say, I'm not getting the performance I need from my team. There's also a second component, which is working relationships, where you may have had this experience where you've worked on a team and the team has produced a really good outcome, but you walk away thinking to yourself,
I'll never do that again.
Exactly. I will never work with that group again. And teams exist over a period of time. And so if you've got a team that really can turn out high performance, but is undermining its working relationships as it does that, over time, it's also going to lose its performance.
Well, you know, we work, Christy and I work within an academic health center. And those who, organizational psychologists such as yourself, who study academic health centers say that is one of the most complex environments, work environments in all of the United States. I guess for multiple reasons of hierarchy and decision making, but I know that these are $3-5 billion healthcare systems. What would might be some of the types of things, because we're in meetings all day long. Are most of the meetings that we're in and the teams that we're facing, are we inadvertently stuck? Do you think that we're inadvertently perhaps not doing what we could be doing, or doing we could do things better?
Absolutely. You mentioned being in health centers, and if you're an academic health center, that is one of the most complex kinds of organizations. It's complex because people who work in those settings often have several appointments. They have a clinical appointment, they have a research appointment, they have an administrative appointment. And when you
teaching,
and when you layer all of those things, the role complexity by itself is huge. Then you've got people who are extremely talented and who have developed their expertise in a field where it's not just that they have learned a set of skills, they've learned to think in a particular way. Physicians, engineers, lawyers, they learn to think in a particular way. And one of the challenges for people who have learned to think in a particular way and have that at the core of their profession is that they come to think that the way they think is right.
Well, of course, because we're doctors.
We're doctors. And when you get two or three or more doctors on a team who disagree with each other, or two or three more or more lawyers or engineers or highly skilled people, everyone comes to the table thinking that he or she is right, and that's the fundamental way in which people begin to get stuck.
So as you introduce this topic to people reading your book, you talk about these concepts of different approaches to leadership and mutual learning. What do you think? We're going to have to take a break pretty soon, but what do you think are the most important sort of concepts that people need to sort of understand before you move forward in teaching us?
I think there are a few key concepts. One is that in order to be effective as a team, you need a set of skills and you need a common mindset that's productive. Second idea is that when we work in ways that get us stuck, we are unaware, by and large, of how we're getting ourselves stuck. We are just blind to it, okay? Because it's really our mindset, our core values and assumptions that are getting ourselves stuck. And those are out of our awareness. They operate like an operating system in a computer. Every computer needs an operating system, and it drives everything that we do, drives all the software that we run. But we don't usually see the problems in our operating system.
Hmm.
And so this really involves understanding, moving beyond behaviors and skills to asking, what is it about the way I'm thinking and working with others that really get us stuck?
Well,
those are the core concepts.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, let's pick up on this concept of how do you identify, if you don't really know that you're acting a certain way, how can you then say that there's even a problem exists? And then how do we move forward into jointly creating a different team environment? Because again, all of medicine today is about teams. It's no longer the physicians. It's the physicians and the health behavior specialists and the social worker and the nurse and even, God forbid, the patients. And I think this is the sort of question I'd love to get here, what you have to say. How do we get them all at the table? Because there is not just one leader. That's what I know you say. We'll come right back with You're Listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Roger Schwartz about his book, Smart Leaders and Smarter Teams. And Dr. Schwartz, you were telling us about some of these key principles of understanding that perhaps you can be, as a leader, blind to being stuck or blind to certain parts of your own thinking that get the team stuck. And I wondered if you might share a little bit more about that. How do I know that I need to read your book and figure this out if I'm blind to even being stuck? Tell us more.
Sure. Let me give an example as a way to illustrate. Worked with an organization that was a global design and manufacturing organization. And the person who headed up this team, this part of this organization, was president of one of the operating groups in the organization. And we'll call him John Haley. It's what I call him in the book. And John was realizing that his team wasn't getting what it needed to get. Essentially, they were facing some financial difficulty. They needed a new strategy for their organization. And they had been working on it for months and had not been able to get a decision. What had happened was, every time they met as a team and they thought they had a decision, someone would come to John's office after the meeting. And you may be familiar with this kind of story.
I think Christie's office is filled with one resident after the other at times.
Oh, man.
And the person would say, John, I didn't want to raise this in the meeting, but... And then the team member would go into a long explanation about why the decision that the team had just made could not be implemented. And John would get very frustrated, but because John believed that his role as the leader of this team, the president of the part of the organization, he basically said, okay, well, we've got to go back and we've got to deal with this. And he would go back and they would deal with it. But people would not talk specifically about why they said to John privately what they said. They wouldn't say that in the full team meeting. And so this happened again and again and again. So what John knew was they weren't getting anywhere. He realized they were stuck. He didn't know why. And in my working with the team, one of the things that I said to John was, so John, you knew that these people were coming to you again and again. Why did you keep on going back to the team meetings and not do anything differently?
To not have the open communication
exactly,
where people could express
said,
their feelings.
He said, I thought my job was to bring this back to the team. Hmm. What he didn't recognize was that he was essentially colluding with the team in a way that those real issues didn't get out. And the real issue was, why is it that a team of really talented, smart leaders could not say in a team meeting what they felt they had to say to John outside? And that's often the situation for many teams.
Well, one of the things, and maybe it was applicable to this example you gave, is that there's not just one leader. And that's, I think we often in the academic health center, we see our boss, our department chairman, the CEO. We think of them as the leader. But you say there's multiple leaders in the room. Couldn't someone else in that environment have identified this problem? It didn't have to just be him.
Absolutely. Anyone on a team can identify any problem and raise it in the team if the team has that mindset. But you're absolutely right, Adam.
Do you have an example of a group you've worked with where you've helped them kind of figure that out? How did they do that?
Well, I'll just fast forward to the same issue, the same team, rather. This is John's team, and it's now a couple of years later. And they have gotten to the point where they are sharing leadership for the team. And at this point, anyone can say anything to move the team forward. And this is a team where, as part of the strategy, they are acquiring a lot of organizations around the world. But those acquisition decisions are made by John and just a couple of other people on the team. Now, John has said to the team, everyone is an equal on this team when it comes to making decisions, and everyone is responsible for everyone else's part of the business. So one team member says in a meeting while I'm there, John, I see a problem. You're asking us to be responsible for everyone else's business, but we're not involved in the decision about what organizations to acquire.
I think in your terminology, discussing the undiscussable, you mentioned that's a skill people need to have.
Exactly. And so by doing that, he was essentially saying, John, I think there's a mismatch between your saying to us, we are really all accountable for each other's businesses and how we're involved in the decision making. And to his credit, John said, you're right. That's a problem.
And that's a real culture shift for an organization if they've been used to sort of this backwards communication pattern to feel safe and to create. So he had to really go in and set a whole new tone for how that was to be done. And I imagine some of that was skill set, but I mean, it sounds like you coached him through it.
Well, not only did we coach John, but we worked with the team as a team because unlike other kinds of changes, this is a change that you can't make only by yourself. John can change his skill set and his mindset, but everyone else needs to change their skill set and mindset as well. So John needs to figure out, how do I do this in a way where I'm not trying to control the whole team? And other members need to change their mindset so they're thinking to themselves, I have a responsibility, I have an accountability on this team, not just to John, who is my boss, but to every other person sitting around the team. And that's a fundamental shift.
Okay, so this is intuitively obvious. What you're saying resonates. But somehow it doesn't sound intuitively easy. By that I mean, we're going to have a group. We're going to have our doctors in our practice and the providers in this primary patient center medical home. And we're going to get patients at the table. We're going to give each one of them a copy of your book, Dr. Schwartz. And then we're going to say, okay, let's do this. What kind of problems are we going to have and how do we solve them? Maybe it's bringing you in to facilitate those meetings, right? Because we could have a commitment, we can read it, but there's something else. I don't know what that is. Is it practice?
Well, part of it's practice. One of the things that I talk about in the book, and actually the last two chapters, are how you as an individual begin to change your mindset and your skill set, and how you as a team begin to change your mindset and your skill set. Because as both of you have described, they are two different but very highly interdependent issues. So to the question of what do? The first thing you do if you're a leader, if you're the formal leader of your team, is you ask yourself the question, how might I be contributing to this team in a way that's ineffective? Many times people complain about the very problems that they're contributing to and they're unaware of.
So you have to bring that to the group.
You have to bring that to the group because, like the emperor's new clothes, we are blind and unaware of our weaknesses. But the good news is, and it really is good news if you're interested in learning and creating more effective organizations, the good news is everyone around sees it. If you want to know how you're doing and where you are getting the team stuck, if you can ask people and you can let them know there will be no retribution for their answers, and that's key, then you can have a beginning of a conversation.
Right? Nice. In those early self-reflection times that should be ongoing for leaders, do you recommend those leadership surveys that are anonymous and very long, or do you recommend open dialogue or both? What is the best approach?
Almost all surveys that are done are anonymous. My problem with anonymous surveys, and I speak as someone who used to work at the survey research center at the University of Michigan developing surveys. My problem with that is that there's no accountability and there's no transparency. So I can say anything I want about you, Christy or Adam, and you won't know why I gave you a 2 on works well with others or shows initiative. And I can make a comment and you won't know who said it.
Is 2 good or bad?
2 is bad.
Oh.
Sorry.
Then I don't want, we're going to throw this one away.
So we're going to send it to you.
I often say to my clients, there's a one question survey you can give people, which is the question is, if I ask you for information, do I have to give you anonymity to get the truth? And if the answer is yes, you have to grant me anonymity to get the truth, then you know you're facing the largest problem you can in your organization. That is, why is it that people can only tell the truth to each other when they're not accountable for it? Hmm. The most fundamental thing that you can be accountable to for your colleagues is telling them how you see your working relationship so that you can improve.
Well, Dr. Schwartz, thank you for taking time with us and giving us some of these helpful thoughts. I imagine people can find your book, Smarter Leaders, Smarter Teams, on Amazon, or what's the best way?
They can find it at Amazon. They can find it on our website, www.schwartzassociates.com.
And they'll find a link on our website. And you said one thing in your book, Dr. Schwartz, that I think is really important for our listeners of your health, because some may really say, what's the relationship here with health? But you summarized it so nicely and why we wanted you to hear. You said, if you apply these principles over time, you'll find that you and your team not only get stuck far less often, which is what you told us today, you'll achieve higher levels of performance, have better working relationships, and enjoy greater well-being. That, to me, is the essence of what we want to promote here in your health. And we thank you for sharing some of your expertise. We encourage our listeners to get your book and explore for themselves.
Great, thank you. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And Christy, we've got some wonderful questions from our listeners today. One about, unfortunately, someone who got sick after going to a party.
And about injuring your foot from dropping a weight on it.
Which we can say, don't do that. We have a question from someone, though, about they feel like their tailbone sticks out, and is that abnormal?
And about bloody noses in the wintertime.
These are some important topics today, Christy. So let's listen to our very first one from our listeners.
I've had a sickness with vomiting and diarrhea after I ate some food at a party. How can I know if it was food poisoning or if it was a virus?
How do you know if it was food poisoning or if it was a virus? Oh, boy. I'm not sure that I can figure that out, Christy. Can you figure it out?
Well, I mean, you could if you tested everyone. But in most instances, food poisoning, just like getting a virus, is something that comes on relatively short, that you get better from without needing antibiotics. Sometimes people need IV fluids if you're vomiting and having that much diarrhea. But in a lot of cases, we don't need to test people for it because it goes away on its own anyway.
Yeah, I guess some questions that might be helpful. Did other people at that party get sick?
Yep.
And certain foods probably are kind of more notorious for this. So sometimes meat that's not fully cooked or chicken or sometimes, fish. You don't see it too much with vegetarian or vegetable-based foods in part. But anything that's been laying out overnight, potentially so. But did everyone else get sick or was it just you?
And the other thing I'd say is if as a part of it you have really bloody or foul diarrhea as a part of it, that could be one of the toxins related to foodborne illness that could need an antibiotic. So if it was really bad and you can't hold on any fluids, then you should go to your doctor to get checked out. And if you're having that really bloody diarrhea, then I would want to get that checked out also. Otherwise, you're probably just going to get better, and hopefully it wasn't the food, because then maybe other people will have it too.
Right. Sometimes if it's a virus and or food poisoning, a lot of times you get
kind of, you know, just the vomiting followed by the diarrhea. If kind of both of them happened at the same time,
well, that's the worst.
Who knows here? We hope you're better. Thank you for sharing that house call. Let's listen to our very next house call, which sounds kind of painful.
I started working out and I dropped a 5-pound weight on top of my pinky toe and the bones that cover that part of my foot. It was bruised and sore with walking, and although it has been several weeks, it occasionally still hurts when I bend my toe a certain way. The bruising is totally gone and it looks normal. Should I get an x-ray?
Well, good for you for starting to work out. That's what we should say first, is congratulations for taking that step towards the rest of your life of health by starting to exercise again. And I'm sorry you got hurt.
And if the 5-pound weights are a little too heavy, maybe start with the 2.5-pound weights. Aww. Here. We don't want you dropping those on your feet. But I'm glad you dropped it only on the pinky toe. Perhaps that was less painful than dropping it on the big toe where you're putting all your weight all the time.
And that toe, it sounds like it's getting better for you. And so in which case, I don't know that an x-ray, to answer your question, I don't know that an x-ray would be that helpful if it's getting better, except for like a little twinge here and there. A lot of times, even if you break your pinky toe, all we do is tape it to the other toe to help it just be stable while it gets better.
But we charge for that type of advice, don't we, Christy? I mean, you gotta put a little piece of cotton in between those two toes, wrap it with some adhesive tape, and we call it buddy taping. That's a pretty fancy term for just taping the toes together, but that is what helps a lot of times, giving that toe some support so it's not hanging out there, because you don't want that toe to kind of catch on something. That's when it can be really painful, and you can actually tear a ligament.
So, I mean, if it wasn't getting better or if it was getting worse in any way, I would certainly go get it checked out. But I'm glad to hear that yours seems to be getting better on its own.
Let's listen to our very next house call about someone who's got an unusual problem that sounds very uncomfortable.
I have a funny tailbone that sticks out from my back, sort of like a tail. I exercise and take good care of myself, but I'm worried that when I get old, I will have problems getting sores on that bone. What can I do to prevent bed sores?
Well, I guess my first question is this painful or not at this point in time, or is it just something that our listener really notices and maybe other people have told them about?
Well, and I've known patients to have tailbones that sort of hurt them when they do sit-ups or doing a lot of exercise where they're putting pressure on that part of their coccyx, or the fancy word for tailbone. And thinking about getting bed sores when you're older, hopefully it's a long time from now, but we have some ideas perhaps.
Yeah, certainly right now you might have extra bone in that area. And some people can get a little more bone in a whole variety of areas. And so that may in and of itself not be abnormal. On the other hand, if you had too much bone in that area and you started to have pain, you probably would want to have that looked at, but some devices that can kind of prevent pressure, because this is what's called Christy mentioned you coccyx. There's something called coccydynia. Maybe our health science librarians can put some information about coccydynia up there, but inflammation of that bone just from pressure itself.
Oh, I've had a patient with that problem, and it really bothers him with biking as a major time when he's sitting a lot, and it bothers him. And he's had some success with different treatments. For preventing bed sores, your question, thinking about those donut hole
cushions.
Sort of cushions that support your bottom. And
when you're sitting on a chair, or you're sitting at the toilet, or you're sitting in your laying in your bed, there are a lot of ways to help prevent direct pressure there.
And, you know, hopefully you won't be bedbound anytime soon. But if you were, you'd want a loved one to sort of know about that spot and to be sure that they're turning you a lot.
And if anyone makes fun of you for having a funny tailbone, you just tell them that makes you special.
Because
we all have something that makes us special, even Christy and I. Let's listen to our very last house call.
My child gets bloody noses a lot in the wintertime. He swears he doesn't pick his nose, but I'm not sure if he's picking it at night. I'm getting tired of washing bloody sheets. Other than cutting his fingernails, do you have any other suggestions?
Oh, I'm
Sounds
so
like
sorry.
This is a problem, isn't it, Christy? This can be a bloody problem.
This can be a bloody problem, and it can be a big mess, and it can be scary for the child and scary for the parents. I think cutting his fingernails is a great idea, and of course, teaching him as much as you can not to pick his nose, because that is the main source of, or the main reason for nosebleeds is digital trauma. Which is trauma from the finger.
Yes, picking your nose. They say you can pick your friends and you can pick your nose, but you can't pick your friend's nose. And in this particular case, sometimes you can put, because the nose will get dry too in the wintertime, so you could put some Vaseline mm-hmm. along the inside of the nose. And
some people use a humidifier just to try to keep that moist.
Yep. And that may alter some taste sensations or whatever the pleasure sensations of that for the child if there's something that doesn't, that has a different sort of odor or taste to it. Hard problem here, but really work on, because the child doesn't want to have bloody noses either. Mm-hmm. No one likes bloody noses, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, we hope those suggestions are helpful to you and that he just grows out of this problem.
Yeah, well, we hope that you will send us future house calls about any issues that you find interesting or important. Christy and I would like to be able to address those on our show. You can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also get in touch with us other ways, like
Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, our new health app. If you just search Your Health, one word, for a free download, you can listen to the show on your iPhone or Droid.
And we want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Roger Schwartz. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.